Hi, my lovely Girls Talk fam. Today's episode includes sexually explicit language, mention of suicide and sexual assault. If these topics are in any way distressing to you, be gentle with yourself. This may not be the Girls Talk episode for you. Inspired by my own journey with mental health, I founded Girls Talk, our own safe space where we share, listen, and support each other. So get cozy and join me, Adjoa Burr, for some much needed Girls Talk. Today we have on the podcast my dear friend Tilly Lawless. Tilly is a queer, Sydney-based sex worker who advocates for sex workers' rights, amongst many other things. Without further ado, my friend Tilly. Oh my God, I don't even know where to begin. Tilly, you guys can't see, but we're holding hands.
Is this part of the recording?
Yeah, it's all part of the recording. You can't see, but we're holding hands because I've been reunited with my great friend Tilly Lawless, who has come from Australia. Tilly, welcome to the Girls Talk podcast.
Thank you. All the way, 24 hours travel.
Mm-hmm. She only came for the podcast. She spent vast amounts of money to come to London for the Girls Talk podcast.
Staying a few days, flying straight back.
So we haven't seen each other in ages. This is how our relationship is.
It's been a baby length time.
Exactly. We're always friends, but our friendship is we get to spend time together in the summer. I met Tilly through Girls Talk. I found you on the interweb and we flew you from Australia to New York and you did our first ever Girls Talk.
Was that the first ever?
Yeah.
No
way. First ever Girls Talk festival.
I had no idea.
Yeah. So when was that?
Beginning of 2018.
18.
Mm-hmm. Very wow. Beginning. Like I think maybe February.
Really?
Yeah.
We've been friends for a while.
Yeah.
Wow.
I remember because it was the first snow I ever saw.
Yes.
In New York.
And you had very little clothes. You were so jet lagged. Do you remember? And we were in New York and you were so jet lagged. And Tilly, I had to fight tooth and nail at the festival because, you know, you'll explain to our lovely listeners the work you do. But because of the work you do and you're opinionated and strong and the stuff you talk about and the company that we were working with at the time was like, no one wants to hear about that. Our girls do not want to hear about that. And I was like, no, we do. Everyone wants to hear about that. And Tilly most definitely brought you brought the most amount of people to that room. I mean, everyone was kind of stood still listening to you as you were like so jet lagged and you were like, I'm not even going to do a speech. You were just like, why don't you just all ask me questions and then we'll just go from there. And so everyone kind of looked at each other and were like, oh my God, what are we going to do? And there were like lots of awkward men, my dad being one of them.
Your dad did walk out at one point. Yeah. I think when I was getting into talking about Thrush.
Yeah, Thrush. Yeah. Thrush got spoken about and I slowly saw my dad just like kind of slide past the door and then like creep, like the door kind of creaked open and he just like slipped out. But he's never forgotten that talk. That's why we're so happy to have you on the podcast because yes, your stories can be quite like out there and not always to like people's kind of like taste because you do, you know, the work you do, the way you speak about things is like honest and truthful. But I think at the end of it, everyone's always very happy to hear someone speak from such a kind of like honest and kind of vulnerable place. So that is how we met. We met in New York.
I loved it and I learned many things that I didn't know. Heard the phrase body count for the first time.
Really?
Yeah. One of the girls asked, do people not want to date you because you have such a high body count? And I was like, what does body count mean? It's a very American term.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When you do things like that, I was kind of quite amazed by the questions. I thought they were all quite brilliant.
You know, people always ask me before I do things like, tell me if there's any questions that are off limits. But I always think even a bad question is a good question because it gives you an opportunity to explain why it might be an offensive question or why someone else might not like it. And I think you kind of have a responsibility when you are kind of a representative of a marginalized community to kind of be put maybe in uncomfortable positions. And I think often questions that come from ignorance can be uncomfortable questions. And I think it's okay that I feel uncomfortable and answer those. So I'm not really one of those people who would be like, that's inappropriate to ask me when I have put myself forward as someone who's speaking about something in public.
Yeah. You're happy to be the teacher.
Yeah. Well, I think if you don't want to be a teacher, don't put yourself in a public position of speaking about something. I think you kind of have to have patience with people's like ignorance and things that might be slightly offensive.
We can go on to that because you've had many of them, many inappropriate and uncomfortable questions. So I know you well, and as my lovely listeners know, we've known each other for a very long time, but I would love if you could introduce yourself to our lovely listeners.
I'm Tilly. I'm 30, just turned 30, and I come from Australia, and I have been a full service sex worker in Sydney for 10 years now. So I started when I was 20. Full service in the sex industry means I'm engaging in penetrative sex. Sex work is obviously like an umbrella term. You can have many things that come under that, say stripping or erotic massage or OnlyFans workers, but I'm specifically engaging in penetrative sex with men, which is what is regarded as prostitution, I suppose. And so I've done that, yeah, for a decade now. And I also, through that time, have done a lot of writing about my work and my life, and also about sex worker rights and how that intersects with women's rights generally and workers' rights. And I've done a lot of public speaking around those things as well. And I'm a lesbian also. I think that's important to say because I
only have sex
with men at work. And I think that has really affected the way I engage with my work.
There was a lot of information there and a lot of nice breaking points for where I want to go with this conversation. But I think first, let's start at the beginning. Like, as you mentioned, you know, with the work that you do, there's obviously a lot of kind of stigma surrounding the work that you do and the work that many people do. Growing up in New South Wales, how did you perceive sex work? Maybe before you even went into it, you were 20. You'll go on to say this, but the work in sex work is decriminalised.
100%. Sydney's the capital of New South Wales. New South Wales is the state. New South Wales was the first place in the entire world to get decriminalisation of sex work. It got it in 1995. I didn't know that growing up, though. I think that because so much of the media you consume is, you know, sex workers being murdered in a TV show or kind of like salacious things and like girls getting arrested and things like that, I just assumed it was illegal. And actually, even when I started working at 20, I thought what I was doing was illegal because it kind of felt illegal. Like I started with an escort agency and, you know, I would go to this apartment in the rocks in the middle of the city and clients would call up on these. The receptionist would sit in this desk with like 8 phones and clients would call up and she'd send you to their house. The client would have, you know, called up and asked for Maria, you know, some fake girl advertised on the website, and she would send you. It felt like I was doing something legal because I was in this dodgy apartment late at night and I was going to these men's houses and I was being paid in cash. And it wasn't actually till maybe about a year into the work that I found out that it was decriminalized.
Wow, really?
Yeah. At the end of the day, because of the stigma around it, even with decrim, it is still a job that operates kind of underground in some ways. And also because I was working at a escort agency, I think if I'd started out in brothel work, I would have quickly realized that it was decriminalized because there's brothels on the street and you're walking in off the street and it's very out in the open. But something about being at an escort agency and being shuttled around to these different apartments and things, it felt very kind of explicit and a bit dodgy.
And when speaking to people, I think a lot of the stigma surrounding sex work often falls under this idea of why someone might decide to do it. I mean, there's a lot of stigma in all different shapes and sizes, but I do find a lot of the time, and even when like introducing you to friends and people, you know, my friends find out what you do, they're like, why does she do it? Just even in that question, I find just as your friend, there's some sort of slight judgment just in that question. Like they expect you to be like, everyone has to be kind of like a wayward, like the films, like a wayward girl on the street. That's why they decide to do work like that, which is obviously not the case.
100%. And I mean, that's because that's how it's been represented in media. And also because working girls, sorry, that's the phrase that we would use within the industry for other sex workers, but working girls are so often kind of trapped in this position of being unable to speak about what they do because of the repercussions they might face, you know, like losing custody of a child, legal repercussions in some places, not being able to be hired in certain jobs in the future if people know they've done that work. Because of that, many women are forced to not speak about it, which means it becomes difficult to even change the views around it because we're kind of trapped within that silence. And I think the other thing is, the reality is sex work is also a job that often marginalized people enter.
Yeah.
I entered it because I had no money. I came from, you know, my dad was unemployed and on welfare, and like I needed the money. And so it's a lot of working class women. You get a lot of women of color. You get a lot of migrant women, a lot of trans women. And so because of that, some of the stereotypes around it are true in that it's often marginalized people in it.
The way you got into it, obviously you kind of just answered my question as to why you decided to kind of...
I needed money. Yeah. And I was like, sex work, drug dealing, weighing between them. And I didn't think I'd be any good at drug dealing.
I'd be so bad.
I would not be discreet enough. And then I started sex work and I went to my first booking.
I've never even seen you with a bag.
No, I would have been used to it. I'd be pulling drugs out of my pockets or my underwear, probably. I don't even wear a bra.
But do you even wear underwear that often?
I'm wearing underwear today.
Okay, that's
but yeah,
good.
I often put stuff down my boots, you know? Yeah. I'd be terrible. To answer your earlier question, I thought it would change me irrevocably. I thought I would have sex with someone for money and I would feel tainted.
Yeah.
And the first client I ever slept with was actually only the second man I'd ever slept with, because I'd always dated women. And I remember we were in doggy and I heard this like noise and I was like, what's that noise? I couldn't work out what it was. It was like a thwap, thwap, thwap. And I was like, I'm not wearing a necklace. Like, it's not something hitting my body. I wasn't used to the sounds of heterosexual sex. And I finally like looked between my legs and like realized it was his beer belly like banging against my arm. It was just like a sound I didn't even know could happen in sex. And I was like, wow, was that it? Like, it was such an anticlimax to sleep.
This was the first time.
First time. Yeah. It was so easy. And men are so easy to make come in comparison to women.
Yeah.
I got given $250, right, in cash, which for me was a crazy amount of money at the time. Like, you know, I used to get $250 from the government a week on welfare, you know? So to make $250 in an hour with this man was absolutely insane. And I was like, oh, I don't feel any different. Like, I don't feel like I've done something wrong or that something has been taken from me.
Because that's a huge misconception from other people, I think.
Yeah.
It's a transactional process. Do they not feel like something's been taken from them? But I think also what I'd love to talk to you about is just the way you talk about sex in general.
Yeah.
What I find, the judgment also comes from this idea, yes, sex is sacred in many ways, but I think the way you talk about it, it keeps its kind of sacred energy and why we choose to have sex with people and what that feels like when it feels real. But do you know what I mean? Like, you don't feel like something's been taken from you.
Well, and I think the other thing is you realize there's plenty of people have transactional sex in life.
But that's what I mean, exactly. They think not every time you have sex with someone is like a life-changing, like kind of beautiful, like movie kind of experience.
Yeah. Like plenty of girls are having sex for validation.
Yeah.
You know, there's that amazing tweet. I don't know if you've seen it, but like, it's like people always complain when a girl fucks the weed man for weed, but like you're fucking the text man for text.
Yeah.
And it's like, yeah, so many girls have fucking a guy so in the morning they wake up to a good morning text and they feel like loved and wanted. And you know, people fuck people to get entry to a nightclub or like to get a photo shoot that they wanted, like
to get a handbag.
Exactly. Yeah. Like there are all kinds of transactional sex. So why is transactional sex with money seen as so different? But I think also I wasn't as disturbed by it because also I mainly date women. So I think it didn't feel like a threat to the sex I was having in my private life. Whereas I know sometimes heterosexual women who do this kind of work, you know, might have sex with clients all day and come home and have sex with their boyfriend and be like, oh no, it feels kind of the same. So there's always been like a clear delineation for me there. I will say the first time I orgasmed with a client, I was thrown.
Really?
Yeah. To have real pleasure with someone that I wouldn't be having sex with if I wasn't being paid, that I wasn't attracted to, that I wouldn't interact with otherwise, that was like, oh fuck, what does a orgasm even mean? But then you realize that our bodies sometimes respond in ways that we can't predict or that we don't want them to. And also, like, to be honest, like life is full of so many awful things that like now I just see it as like a bonus when I have a pleasurable time with a client.
Yeah.
I'm like, great, I'm being paid and I'm enjoying it, you know? And it doesn't actually take away from the orgasms I have with someone I love.
Yeah. What did your kind of family and friends like think about it?
So I kept quiet for the first definitely like 18 months to 2 years. Like my close friends knew, but yeah, I kept it quiet from my extended family. I told my dad maybe like a year into it. He was really unhappy, but also he was like, well, you're an adult. And he was like, you support yourself financially. He was like, I don't support you. So he was like, I don't think I can really tell you how you make money. My extended family, when they found out a few years in, which wasn't through me telling them, it was through other people telling them, it went down really badly. But my extended family is quite Christian. I mean, I was already gay. I feel like gay prostitute. It was like double whammy, you know, like
throwing the holy water on you.
They were also very confused.
Yeah, but they got their head around it.
My dad and my brother are totally, yeah, I'm close with them. But my extended family, no, like that did cause a huge fraction in my family, and I'm still estranged from my extended family. But I was estranged from one half of my family already for like complicated family reasons. So I feel like I didn't have the attachment to family that some people might have had. Like I haven't seen my mum since I was 17. So I think losing a family member was less confronting to me than it might have been to other people.
Within the community, are the stories very kind of varied in regards to why someone chooses to be,
I mean, it's definitely most of the time, I would say 99% of the time it's for money that someone's entered. But the stories of why people need money are, of course, very varied. Yeah. Like there's a lot of single mums to the work, a lot of uni students who are studying.
I only ask because I think it goes into this stigma.
In Australia specifically, because of the laws, we get a lot of women coming over from Southeast Asia and East Asia and South America who have done this work in their own countries and have come to Australia because the money is better, the laws are better, and they can send money home to their families. Mm-hmm. And I think sex work in general is often tied to stories of like migration. Any country you go to, you get so many migrant sex workers because it's often one of the few industries that someone can enter when they don't, for example, have maybe a proper working visa, or they don't speak the language in the country they've come to, or they're not educated at university or something. Sex work is a industry that has low barriers to entry. To enter, all you kind of really need is your body.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really, really tied to people trying to create a better life for themselves.
I suppose I want to jump back a bit. You're a lesbian, but you have sex with men at work. It has changed your perception of men outside of work. What does that look like?
I think in my initial years, I was maybe made cynical about men, because you see how many men are cheating. And also when I was young in the industry, you know, I was 20 and I looked 16, and most of the clients who picked me were in their 60s, you know. So you become quite kind of disillusioned and creeped out in some ways. But actually, the older I've got in the industry, the more I have felt, I think, sympathy.
We've spoken about this.
Yeah, for a lot of the men I see. So I think also the kind of client I see is very different. So when I started out, I was working in the city and I was mainly seeing like upper middle class, like white men.
Bankers.
Exactly. And they will often be condescending to me and, you know, see me as, you know, just a sex worker or whatever, and assume that I would be an idiot and all that kind of stuff. And also I always felt there was like a power dynamic between them paying for me and me needing the money. And as I've gotten older and become more financially stable, and I will say have remained in the industry out of choice rather than just financial need, so my relationship to me being in the work has changed. But also I have worked in other places now. So for many years I've worked in suburban brothels, and the clients who tend to come into them tend to be often South Asian clients or East Asian clients, and are often migrants. And they're often men who have come over alone from the country they've grown up in to make some more money to send home to their families, or to make some more money so then they can go back home eventually and get married or to study. And often they are like lonely men who I think are disenfranchised from dating. It can be difficult for them to date with a language barrier.
Mm-hmm.
They're not necessarily seen as desirable in a country like Australia. Mm-hmm. And also often a lot of my clients are more on a level with me class-wise. Like they are men who are doing labor with their body just like I'm doing labor with their body, and they treat me more as an equal. And so I think my idea of men as like us versus them, you know, has really changed. I think I see now that everyone is kind of in many ways negatively influenced by the patriarchy. Like men can be oppressed by the patriarchy too, and especially men who aren't white and men who are working class as well. So it's been a nice transition through my decade of work. I can still have awful clients, but there are awful clients just as there are awful men in general.
Yeah.
I don't think a man is any worse because he's a client.
That's very interesting. Where do you think this comes from? When you hear that your partner has slept with a sex worker, there's always this kind of anger, resentment, judgment towards your partner for doing something like that. I definitely was that person, by the way. Yeah.
I think there would be people who would be anti it because they're like, you're exploiting that woman by sleeping with her. I think the other aspect is that people assume that people who book sex workers are people who can't pick up.
Yeah.
So it's like, oh, you're undesirable. You must be gross if you've seen a sex worker, which is crazy because I have had many extremely attractive clients. Like often men just don't have time to date or don't have the desire to date. Or sometimes I'll have a client who's like, I don't really want to go on a date with a girl off Tinder and buy her dinner. And then like maybe we have sex and it's transactional, but we're pretending it's not transactional. He's like, I'd rather it just be out in the open. It's simple. We know what we're getting. I think my view of that has also changed over time because I get a lot of clients now who aren't like cis men, you know. I get a lot of women clients, I get a lot of couples booking me, and in my head I was more judgmental of men booking a sex worker than I was of a couple booking a sex worker.
Yeah, you know, that's like, what I mean. Same, yeah, exactly.
When couples book me for a threesome, I'm like, oh, that's fun, you know, but like when a man would book me, I'd be like, oh, that's a bit sad. No, it can also be fun, you know. That's also about, I think, the perceived reflection on you as a partner, that like your partner's behavior, like your partner is less desirable, therefore it also affects maybe your own value of yourself.
Well, it's like porn as well, I think.
Yeah.
People who have like a, you know, my boyfriend watches porn, this is how it makes me feel. No judgment, everyone has their own insecurities. But I think it's something, it must be like, he's searching for something that I can't give him or...
Totally. Like people being threatened by that, which I mean... To me, it's wild because I think you can never completely sexually satisfy everyone for their entire life. Like, I think it's natural to have fantasies beyond a monogamous relationship.
1,000,000%. Yeah. But that's why, like, I was talking to my boyfriend about flirting.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, it's a natural human thing to do is to flirt with people. Coffee shop man, girl at the shop, you know, eyes, whatever it is, it's just a natural human thing to find humans attractive. And anyway, he went out flirting. I don't know why he took it upon himself to do this, but he went out and about and did some flirting, and he just wasn't very good at it. And he felt quite bad about it. And I had a lot of friends who were like, oh, did that really upset you? And I was like, no, not at all. You know, I have many insecurities. Don't get me wrong, I'm by no means like some like very chilled, laid back kind of like woman that you see on some like kind of cool TV show. I've definitely got my psycho tendencies.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
That for some reason it just isn't one of them. I'm not threatened in that way like porn or him finding another person attractive. I would be lying to myself, and I would hate for him to lie to me and say that he thought I was the only attractive person on the planet.
Woman in the world. Yeah, totally. It's also just like, it's not like people have a finite amount of love or sexual attraction to give, and someone else is like taking your reserve from you, and it's like your partner has less to give you because they find that person attractive. I don't know. I think in the straight world especially, and actually amongst lesbians too, I will say, is that we're kind of taught to like quantify love by possessiveness. So this person loves me so much because they want to keep me to themselves. And I think that's something we kind of like have to untangle and be like, what does it mean to love someone, allow them to also be independent?
And is it that quite interesting when you're sleeping with couples, you see that kind of dynamic?
Totally. I mean, some girls don't like working with couples because it can be quite complicated, because some couples come in to celebrate, but some couples will also book a sex worker because they're having... issues in their relationship, you know, in the same way that some couples will buy a dog if they're fighting. And some couples will come in because maybe one of them wants to sleep with other people and the other one doesn't, and they'll decide halfway on booking a sex worker and compromise. And sometimes you can tell that one of them isn't comfortable with it, you know. And a friend of mine once actually was on top of the man in the couple, and the wife threw a candle at her head.
What, thought she was really into it and then actually saw it?
And then saw it, yeah,
in
exactly.
Its physical, like, form, and was like, I hate this girl.
Poor girl, like, she's just being paid to be there, you know? Like, it's not like she wants to fuck the boyfriend. So, I mean, I always say with couples that it's the woman that you have to win round and the woman that you have to pay attention to. Yeah, I mean, all this stuff around, like, possessiveness, though, and finding other people interesting and stuff, I feel like also comes up to not just in people who are in relationships seeing a sex worker, but also in being a sex worker and dating and how people perceive that. I mean, I personally don't have much difficulty with it because I am queer and the people I date don't tend to be so threatened by my work. But like a lot of my straight friends in the industry struggle to find like boyfriends who are okay with them fucking men for money.
Really?
Yeah. Because the men, I think, inevitably compare themselves to the clients, and also they think it's a hit to their masculinity to allow their woman to be fucked by someone else. Whereas when I have dated women, they're like, oh, you fuck men at work, no worries, you know, you're spending your life with me and I'm a woman, you know.
What is it different when you sleep with women?
For work or for pleasure?
For work.
Oh my God. When I sleep with women at work, I mean, I love getting women clients, but I get nervous with women clients.
Why?
Well, because I worry if they're going to like me. I like think about the woman client and I'm like, oh my God, do you think I can message her? Do you think she's going to book me again? Like, I love getting women clients. There's a lot of my male clients that I have fun with as well, though. I've learned that sexual like attraction and chemistry doesn't actually equal sexual compatibility. So there are plenty of people that I don't find sexually appealing, but then I have amazing sex with them.
Really?
And then there are people who I find sexually appealing, and then when I fuck, it's like no vibe. So I think sexual pleasure is so much more like complicated and also fragile than we even realize. And it's like so dependent on our own moods as well. In that, like, I can be feeling so horny and enjoy sex with a client that I find absolutely repulsive, but just because I happen to be horny in that moment. And actually, sometimes I find sex with the repulsive clients the best kind of sex because I'm really relaxed.
Really?
Yeah.
Just like, not trying.
I'm not trying. Orgasm a lot easier.
Pillow princess.
Totally. Yeah. Whereas, like, with like a hot client, I'm kind of like a little bit more like nervous and I can't quite let go. And there's also some, I think, a little power thing I sometimes get off on when the client's really, really ugly, where I'm like, God, you're so lucky to be fucking me right now. And aren't I just amazing? You know, like.
There's so many things I want to ask you, but you speak a lot about kind of libido. Do you feel like you have a kind of enjoyable kind of like personal sex life as well?
Work has definitely lessened my libido because I just have so much sex all the time that when it comes to my private life, often I just can't be bothered. Like the person has to really be extremely hot for me to even consider having sex with them. Extremely hot and other things, obviously. But I've done work for so long, like basically all of my adult life, that it's really hard for me to envision what kind of person I would have been or how I would have been different sexually if I hadn't done it. I actually don't have much sex in my private life. Like I will occasionally, you know, go to a swingers club and like fuck a bunch of people, but I probably only have sex in my private life like once every 4 months and I don't date. I'm a lot more, I think, celibate than people expect me to be. I do wonder, like, if I hadn't worked for 10 years, would I be out like slutting around? It's really, really hard for me to know, or if, to know that my lack of libido is just something that happens naturally with age. And at the moment, also, I'm grieving too. So my lack of libido, I know, is also tied to that. I think it's something I'm still wrapping my head around, which is probably why I bring it up in conversation.
I mean, I feel like I grapple with that. It's not just something I think about very often.
Yeah.
I mean, when I do think about it, I really think about it. But it's just something that doesn't necessarily like immediately come to mind. And I have to work to become a sexual person because I know it's an important part of my relationship.
Totally. Have you heard of spontaneous first responsive desire?
No.
Because a friend was talking to me about it the other day and it really helped me. So spontaneous desire is like desire that appears by itself, you know, so you're by yourself and you're thinking about sex and you're horny. But responsive desire is that you don't actually feel desire till something sexual begins. Yes. So in reaction to someone else. So like you start having sex and you start to enjoy it. I think when I was younger, I might have felt spontaneous desire a fair bit. Like in my teens, I would have been like, damn, I want to go out and get railed, you know, and we've masturbated a lot and stuff. But I think now at this point in my life, usually I don't actually feel horny till I'm in the midst of sex.
That's 100% me.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, what's wrong? Like, shouldn't I feel like, you know, yeah. I have to be in it.
Yeah, you have to be in it. And that's, yeah, apparently like a very, very normal thing. And now that I know that, I will now force myself to initiate sex even when I'm not horny, because I know once it begins, I will start feeling horny.
That's really cool to know. Because otherwise you feel like, you know, again, it's just like misconceptions and watching probably too much like TV or something. One thinks maybe it has to be like this lead up and it gradually gets even more, you know, sexual and sexual, but actually it's always quite mundane actually.
Oh, totally. Sex is the most like normal thing in the world. I mean, I see sex as like, I think because I've had so much of it, to me, it's like eating a meal. It can be both incredible and boring and, you know, it's so dependent on all the other things around it.
Yeah. You've been a sex worker for 10 years. I mean, we've spoken about some of the biggest misconceptions, but I'd love to go a little bit more into that. But also, from your point of view, what's the relationship between sex work and liberal feminism today?
So, unfortunately, sex workers have a really complicated relationship with feminism in general, because when you come to like the second wave feminists, they were about women living a certain way. I feel like in some ways it was almost about like emulating men, you know, it was about getting a position as a CEO. It was about like
girl boss.
Yeah. It was about like not wearing makeup, all those kind of things. And so with second wave feminism, you get a lot of SWERF sentiment, which is sex worker exclusionary radical feminist sentiment, and a lot of TERF sentiment as well, which is trans exclusionary radical feminist. So a lot of feminists who are anti-sex work are also anti-trans, because they see both of those things as catering to the patriarchy. Sex workers catering to the patriarchy because it's exploiting women for men's desires and it's objectifying women when women shouldn't be sexual objects. Trans men are betraying women by wanting to join the patriarchy, and trans women aren't even really women. They're just men who want to like have access to women. So unfortunately, a lot of the big feminists that really drove the second wave feminist movement and have formed the feminism of today had those kind of views. So like Gloria Steinem did, for example. Third wave feminism, liberal feminism, I think is complicated because some liberal feminists do support sex work, but they support it from the point of view of like girl boss feminism, as you said, which is like kind of women have the right to do what they want to do with their bodies, which I agree with. But for me, support of sex worker rights is more tied to workers' rights. I think when you're just talking about like women's right to do whatever the fuck they want to do, then you can argue that women have a right to become a CEO for a mining company and make heaps of money and fuck up the planet, you know, because she's doing the best thing for her. Mm. And you're not thinking about what's best for the community. So I think supporting sex worker rights from that angle of like individuals should be able to make money the way they want to make is kind of a bit of a hollow argument, because for me, I come from more of a community perspective of feminism. Like I think we should actually be serving the community. And so for me, the real reason to support sex worker rights is because at the end of the day, it's a job and we should be entitled to labor rights the way anyone else is, regardless of how you feel about a job morally. Like we should have labor protections. And I think it's also important to recognize that I also come from the pragmatic view of that sex work has always existed and will always continue to exist. Like I know in an ideal world, we should say that no one would ever have the financial need to enter the sex industry because people should have like a, you know, a basic living wage and be given places to live and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But we don't live in that world. And so from that point of view, I think we need to make the working conditions of people who are in the sex industry, whether because they want to be or because they're coerced to by capitalism, we should make their working conditions as safe as possible. We should never be jailing a woman because she has kids and can't afford to do anything else and is doing sex work. It's so complicated because, yes, women can be seen as sexual objects by clients and women are selling a sexual service with their bodies. But I mean, women are sexualized and objectified anyway. It's an interesting question because it actually within the sex industry, there are debates as to whether, you know, some sex workers argue that in an ideal world, sex work shouldn't exist, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And that, like, if we had socialism, sex work wouldn't exist. There wouldn't be a need for it.
Where do you sit?
I think sex work would exist anyway. I think there would be less sex work if people under socialism, for example, you know, if people could afford to have other choices, there would definitely be many women who chose not to enter the industry. But for me now, knowing that I can afford to quit this job if I wanted and could enter other industries, and I still choose to do it, I know that there are other women who also must be in the same position as me. And I don't think it is innately a bad thing to pay for sex or sell sex, you know?
I know that within the community, there are a lot of different kind of opinions as to what one wants the kind of climate and the work to look like.
There's a lot of discussions too about, like, obviously respectability in the community, because some sex workers are like, we should aspire to be as, you know, normal as possible and show that we're deserving of rights because we're like other people. Like, respectability politics, have you heard that phrase before?
No, no.
So respectability politics exists in the queer community, the Black community, migrant community, sex worker community. The idea of respectability politics is that we should seek the approval of the status quo. In queer people, it's like, we shouldn't be having too much sex. We should be getting married. We should be having houses. We should be paying tax.
Okay, I get what you're saying.
Yeah, and we should show that we're deserving of respect. So there's sex workers who are like, we should show that we're normal and like other people. And then there's also sex workers who are like, no, we should be able to be messy and like take drugs and be flawed. And we should still be able to have our rights, you know, even if we behave in a way that isn't perceived as desirable. And I obviously fall on that side of the spectrum, you know, like I think we should have.
You don't need to suddenly start wearing a suit and wanting the kind of like ideal kind of lifestyle.
Yeah, totally.
To be deserving of what we all have.
Totally. You shouldn't be deserving of human rights because you're respectable. You should be deserving of human rights because you're human.
Yeah.
And I feel that about queer people, sex workers, whatever. Drug users are definitely not seen as respectable, but it's like, of course they should still be treated like a human, you know?
Homeless people.
Yeah, homeless people, you know, criminals in jail who lose their rights. Of course they should fucking have their rights, you know? They should still be allowed to vote. They shouldn't even be in jail in the first place. And not as in they shouldn't have made choices that sent them to jail. I mean, that I don't really know how I even feel about jails in general, because it's mainly marginalized people who end up in them. But these inter-community conversations are interesting.
You spoke about at the beginning about the kind of the umbrella around sex work and the different kind of categories or whatever you want to call them. Does it vary between kind of, I suppose, like brothel work and porn work?
Oh, 100%. So we refer to the hierarchy that exists in sex work and shouldn't exist. Yeah, we call it a whorarchy.
Whorarchy.
Yeah. So like it kind of changes where you are depending on laws and stuff, but like it tends to kind of go like street-based sex workers are seen as the bottom rung.
Yeah.
And then you get like brothel workers, and then you get like, you know, maybe massage parlors workers, and then escorts, and then you kind of have like phone sex workers and online workers, and then you have like sugar babies. Sugar baby is one of those things that falls in kind of a gray area where some people don't even necessarily see it as sex work because it mimics like a traditional monogamous relationship, and also because in some places where it's
and the patriarchy to a certain extent.
Completely, yeah. it does. And in some places where it's illegal to do more obvious forms of sex work, sugar baby work can kind of fall in the gap, because maybe you're getting paid in an apartment and a handbag instead of getting paid directly in cash. That's the hierarchy. And within the hierarchy, we have got it so complicated because, for example, you get what we call lateral whorephobia, which is like, yeah, whorephobia within the sex industry. So you'll get strippers who are like, oh, I'm not a prostitute. Like, I would never have sex with someone for money. And a lot of OnlyFans workers really make that
decision. That's what I really wanted to talk to you about, OnlyFans. So
yeah,
I'll remind myself to go
talk
back
about OnlyFans. Yeah. And then in the reverse of that, you also have brothel workers who might be like, oh, you know, she's just a stripper. Like, she's not actually a sex worker. The needs of some of us are different within the community. You know, you can never have one homogenous need for the whole community, beyond the fact that I think all of it should be decriminalized, obviously. And I should also note, decrim is something that I feel like it's responsible to say this, is that both Amnesty International and the World Health Organization support as the policy that would
decriminalization.
Most, yeah, that would most like protect the human rights of people in the sex industry, yeah. You know? So it's by far the most favorable policy that you can work under. But beyond having decriminalization of the industry, I think people's needs within it are so varied because people's lives are so different. And also the other thing is that people's politics within it are so different. Mm-hmm. Like often, you know, when I'm working at a brothel, like when I was younger, I would think, you know, there is some camaraderie and solidarity, but like often you're working with someone who has completely different political views to you. And just because we have the same job doesn't mean we have the same outlook on things.
I wanted to kind of talk about this, like, online always mentality and the way that that might have kind of impacted sex work. What's your kind of personal relationship with OnlyFans?
Yeah, so I mean, I did OnlyFans in lockdown, but only because brothels were closed and I couldn't work. And I personally hated it.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, I don't like spending that much time on the laptop anyway. I feel like we're on the internet enough as it is. But also one of the main reasons I didn't like it was because I do find it life-affirming to have moments of connection with my clients, and especially when they're people that I wouldn't have met otherwise.
Well, you have such beautiful stories of like people who, you know, haven't had sex at all or are confined to their house for disability reasons,
mental
health reasons, you know?
Yeah. So on OnlyFans, you have no connection because it's behind a screen. You don't know who these people are. They're just sending you a message asking, can you make this custom video? And it's also, God, just so much self-promotion. And I'm not into like online promotion and things like that anyway. I just felt like it lacked the soul that sex work can have for me. And I'm not saying full service in-person sex work has that for everyone, because plenty of full service sex workers hate their work and hate their clients. But for me, it lacked that connection. And it also lacked the humor. I think sex is quite absurd and quite fun. And I often have really ridiculous moments with my clients, even if they don't know it's ridiculous. You know what I mean? Like they might be thinking we're having a really normal sex time, but like actually like I'm laughing into the sheet while, you know, they're fucking me. So it's like OnlyFans had none of that. I found it quite, you're kind of siloed away, you know, like you're sterile in your bedroom. Yeah, exactly. The other issue was, from a more pragmatic point of view, is that OnlyFans deletes accounts of people who do sex work in person because they don't want to be seen as soliciting or encouraging prostitution. So if you're on OnlyFans and you have an advert as an escort, your account can be deleted and your money can be confiscated. For example, they ban certain words on it, like you can't even say the word meat, because I don't want anyone to arrange meetups through it. So it meant also that my income on it was quite precarious, because I was always aware of the fact that my account could just be deleted and my funds frozen. And what it forces a lot of workers to do who have done in-person work is they end up having to make a decision between the two. Like it is kind of hard to keep up the both. And the other thing about OnlyFans is, and this isn't from my point of view, but in general, is that people see OnlyFans as really lucrative, and it is to a very, 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 very small minority. So it's like you're making a lot of money, sure, if you're in like the top
2%. Well, that's 2%. What I mean. Now, having an OnlyFans account, it almost falls into kind of like a celebrity category now, no?
Totally.
It's like very lucrative, like you said.
Well, it's lucrative if you already have a platform.
Yeah, so that's what I mean. Yeah. But if you know, you can gain like fame in many ways from it,
if you already have a platform. That's where so many reality TV stars and influencers and stuff are going to it now. But what people don't realize is like 98% of people aren't really making any money, and it just takes years to build a platform from scratch if you don't already have one. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got to have an Instagram and a Twitter, and you've got to be posting, and like there's stats online. I can't remember exactly what the stats are, but it's something like, you know, like 60% of people on OnlyFans are making less than $200 a month. It's crazy how little most people are making on it.
But we're just seeing these kind of like miracle stories.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, to be honest, it's the same in many industries. Like I would say acting is probably the same. Think of how many aspiring actors who never get an acting job there are in the world, you know? And we think of only the success stories because they're the ones that are visible to us. So I don't think OnlyFans is like any more or less likely to succeed than any other form of work that requires you to build a platform and become famous, you know. But it is a hostile platform to in-person sex workers, and they also don't have the backs of sex workers because, like, you know, a few years ago they talked about removing sexual content and they ended up backtracking with that because there was such a big backlash. But from that you can see that they are willing to kick sex workers off at a moment's notice if that will serve them better. So it's a tenuous platform. And even the really successful OnlyFans girls that I know always say, I don't think it'll be around forever. I'm here to make the money while I can, because its bubble will burst, or, you know, once again, they might decide to delete sexual content. Also, the other thing about OnlyFans, which I think a lot of people don't realize when they go on OnlyFans, is like you have to sign up with your ID. And OnlyFans has been known to have leaks with the ID. So, for example, when you're doing sex work in person, it is actually possible to do it without giving away any of your actual details. Like, I've worked with girls in the brothel who've done it for 10 years without anyone knowing that they've done the work, because they're husband thinks they work as a cleaner. You know, they come in the daytime. There's no photo of them on the website. They're working under a fake name. They're being paid in cash. It's completely untraceable. And so you're actually in some way safer in terms of your identity working in person than you are working on OnlyFans, where you give up your ID, the money's coming into your account. And we're seeing the effects of that now, because a lot of influencers are getting turned away from entering America who do OnlyFans work. There was quite a famous one in Australia called Michaela Testo, who has like, I don't even know, like fucking 5 million Instagram followers or something, and has an OnlyFans where she does like topless photos and stuff. And she just got turned away from America a few weeks ago because America has really strict prostitution laws and they see OnlyFans as a form of prostitution. And so even though she's never had sex with a client per se, she's making sexual content online and they've turned her away.
I mean, there has been a conversation around the opinion that maybe celebrities who are kind of taking over that OnlyFans space are potentially taking money away from sex workers.
Yeah, I think it was more that they were gentrifying the platform.
Yeah, and that, kind of answered that. It's more
Yeah. And that then OnlyFans could turn around and be like, well, now we only want the celebrities. We don't want these people doing sex content. So I think that was more the issue with that. I reckon that moment has kind of passed. I feel like every time there's kind of some new tech that like people both don't understand and is like kind of ties into.
I have
some,
no
like,
idea tools. What even OnlyFans looks like. Do you know the layout?
So not user friendly.
Yeah, do you
know
what I
mean? Terrible. It's so terrible. And you can't get it on the Apple store because it's banned because of the sexual content, which is one of the reasons they wanted to keep the sexual content off so they could be on like Apple store along with other apps. I mean, also in the long term, the issue with OnlyFans is that it's another example, I guess, of like the gig economy. Deliveroo, Uber and Airbnb, all those kind of things, how Uber riders are treated like employees but have no real protections of employees. Mm. And I think OnlyFans is like that, in that you don't really have recourse if your account is shut down and your money is taken away, and like you're making money for a platform that doesn't actually care about you or protect you in any way. I think that's a wider issue with like a lot of precarious work that people have these days. And that's also an issue that exists in the sex industry generally, because often we kind of fall in the gray area between we're technically independent contractors, but often we'll be treated as employees, but not given the benefits of being employees. And there's also a huge debate within the sex industry of like, do we want to unionize and become employees, or do we want to remain independent contractors and have more independence and more say, but less protections? In America at the moment, there's been some strippers that have been unionizing and like wanting to become employees, whereas like a lot of brothel workers I speak to have no desire to become an employee because they still want to have say over the hours they work and things like that. So, you know, different horses for different courses.
Yeah.
You know?
God, we've spoken about a lot. You know, in this season of the Girls Talk podcast, we've been exploring grief in all its forms. You know, we are friends, so I know what you've been going through, but I was heartbroken to hear about your friend Sarai's death. And if you're comfortable with sharing, we'd just love to know about your friend.
Yeah. That's nice.
Yeah, I'd love to know.
I didn't actually know that grief was the focus of this.
It's not even, but for some reason it has been. I think our community, you know, under the backdrop of COVID, you know, to many people it feels like centuries ago, and it was, because life has moved on, but we are seeing the repercussions in all shapes and sizes. And I think one of those is definitely grief. Whether you lost someone, or you've lost a way of life, or
totally
a way of dealing with things, you know, like many of the topics that we speak about on Girls Talk, that there's so much kind of stigma and kind of discomfort surrounding a lot of these subjects. And I think grief and death is one of those big ones that people are kind of like, I don't want to talk about this. Yeah, but we'd love to know about Soraya and how you're coping as well.
So Soraya's like, she's a good friend of mine who is also a working girl, she has, it's hard not to talk about her in first person still, actually. I still find it hard to switch to past tense with her, but she passed away at the end of January. She was 29 and she had done sex work since she was 17 and we met through work and became really close straight away because, I mean, we always joked about the fact that we were both really like wholesome kind of whores. Like, you know, we would go to work.
Riding.
Like,
Tilly loves riding, by the way.
Yeah, I love the horse riding. Yeah. And like, we both love the beach and like, we like to just, you know, lie around and watch TV and like read. And like, yeah, we weren't like into partying and we weren't spending our money on like heaps of plastic surgery or designer clothes or whatever. Like, we kind of liked that kind of like chill life. And we also were both like hustling to wanting to buy a house and like we both wanted to have children and we wanted to raise those children alone as like single mums and working girls. And she was, in the real sense of when people say like bad bitch, like she was like that, in that she was also extremely complicated and fought with people a lot, wasn't afraid of fighting with people, and also wasn't afraid of fighting with clients. When I have difficulties with clients, I tend to try and just like cool the situation down, you know, even if it's to my detriment, you know, just because I don't want it to escalate. But she would easily pick a client that fucked her over. He could be 6'4" and she would pick a fight with him and she wouldn't be afraid. And I always found that something so impressive in a woman, let alone in a sex worker who is seen by society as more disposable. It's been difficult because I both miss her and like love her, and also it was suicide, and I feel like that's always makes things extremely difficult and there's like a guilt there. But it's also been really hard to get back into work because she was the person that if I had a difficult client or if I had a funny client, she would be the person that I would call to talk to about it, and she did the same with me. So for a while their work was quite difficult, and also orgasming was difficult for a while there because I would orgasm and I would remember that she was never going to feel this again, and that she, oh God, I hate saying she was so alive because I feel like people throw that around, but she was so alive in the sense of that she was so fucking combative, you know? She was always having conflicts with people. Would, for example, she was in like a group chat with two gay guy friends and like left the group chat because she had a fight with them. And then showed up on their doorstep unannounced the next morning. And when they let her in, she said, okay, I'm ready to be let back into the group chat now. Just like a true diva and a true fucking hard worker who, had worked from 17 to 29 in sex work to buy herself a house. And it actually had just bought herself a house, and a house that was a fucking flex for a first house.
Really?
Like right on the beach, two bedroom apartment. I mean, but that was her way of doing things, you know. She liked to flex on people because she worked hard. I feel like she reminded me of you with that, actually, because I feel like you really value your possessions and are particular about them, but that's because you know the work that's gone into them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something I understand too, because I'm also the same. And I'm still trying to, I guess, work out that thing of like people say where you're like trying to honor the person. You know, I send her celebrity gossip and memes still that I know that she would have liked. And, you know, the new season of The Kardashians is out, and I know she would have wanted to talk about that with me. It's a really hard thing. It's a really fucking sad thing to have someone die who had a really, in many ways, had many things set against them.
Mm-hmm.
Like I think I said to you earlier, you know, she was Sri Lankan in Perth, which is like a very white city. You know, she had a difficult family life in some ways, and she'd done it all herself. With all kind of odds set against her. And so I think it's hard for someone to make it through that. And of course, people who are marginalized in many ways, we lose them, you know.
It's nice to hear about her.
Yeah.
Oh, I love you.
I love you too.
I love you. That was so brilliant. Fun. I really appreciate you. I love you so much.
Absolutely. My pleasure.
I love that you've been finally, after all these years, we have you on the Girls Talk podcast. You're very, very, very special, special human. Thank you so much, Tilly, for coming on the podcast. You can follow Tilly on Instagram at Tilly_Lawless. If you like what you heard today, we'd love for you to join the Girls Talk podcast every week by subscribing to our pod and writing us a review. And as always, mad amounts of love. We may have stopped talking, but that doesn't mean you have to. Talk to us on our Instagram at Girls Talk, or send us your poetry, essays, stories, artwork, or anything else you want to share at girlstalk.com. This week's podcast was produced by Girls Talk and Wicked Child Studio. Original music composed by Mikey Long. Mad love to Jo Malone London for their generous support of the podcast. And as always, we are always here and we're always listening. I'm Adjoa Boa, and this was the Girls Talk podcast.